GoDaddy.com. Use the code BLU139 to get 10% off any combination of purchases at GoDaddy.com. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1349, June 4, 2010.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from work. Had to go back to work today. I ended up picking a load up this afternoon. About it was a 3 p.m. loading appointment over at Stillwell, Oklahoma, which is... Well, it's like 38 or 40 miles from where I live in northwest Arkansas. It's just over the border, basically, in Oklahoma. On a, you got to go through a little maze of skinny little roads to get to it. So it takes a little, probably an hour and 15 minutes to drive over there. But in any case, pick that load up, and then that load delivers late Friday evening Eastern time to Suwanee, Georgia, wherever that is. So in any case, I've made it over here to Fairhaven, Mississippi. Fairhaven is just outside of Memphis. Memphis is in down in the, if you look at the map, Memphis is down in the southwest corner, the very southwest corner of Tennessee, and the Mississippi River separates Tennessee from Arkansas. And so, Memphis is just right up against the Mississippi River. And then the southern border, the southern side of Memphis, you just cross right into Mississippi. And I'm on U.S. Highway 78, which, it's, in the past it was just a highway, but, over the years they've completely upgraded it to a freeway. So, pretty much. So, in any case... there's this truck parking area, this parking area that, so I parked here, and that's where I'm spending the night at. And, it's kind of weird. I've always thought it was kind of strange. If you look at the map, you just find a map, you find your Rand McNally map, or find any map of Memphis, and you kind of, back out of it so you can kind of see the, the area that it covers. And then, look at, south, just south of Memphis and on the Mississippi side, you've got several little towns, but a couple of them have sort of almost quasi-racist names. And I'm surprised, I've never really heard anybody complain about it. Maybe they do. Maybe the people in Memphis have, some people have complained about it. But one of the towns, is the name of it's White Haven. And right here where I'm parked at, I looked on the GPS, what's the closest town? So I could write it down on my logbook, and it said, what's Fairhaven? I don't know. Those seem innocuous enough, White Haven, Fairhaven. But... Kind of interesting, huh? And this is the South. So, I don't know. It would be interesting to kind of research the names of these two towns in particular and find out where they came from. You know, because they've been, you know, they've had these names for, you know, longer than I've been alive. So, anyway, it was kind of a, you know, kind of another kind of a hot day. They, you know, initially, you know, I had my alarm set at home. I've got this old clock radio, and that's what I use when I'm at home to as my alarm to wake myself up with. And you know, and I listened to it, you know, when it woke me up, I listened to a little bit of it, and they were kind of gave a little quick weather forecast. And they, you know, I've got it tuned to a local radio station, and you know, that's about the only time I listen to the radio is, you know, when it, I'm at home and I've got my alarm clock set. But in any case, it's going to be cooler, a little cooler today, and there's going to be, you know, some rain possibly. Well, it never did happen. Now, once I don't know, I did run into a little bit of rain before, I think it was before I got to Memphis. Did run into just a little bit, but it really didn't amount to much. And it's, but it is, it's just kind of hot and, you know, hot and humid. It's cool to, you know, it's probably still in the 70s here right now, you know, even though it's, you know, like 12:39 a.m. It's fairly warm and it's humid. And this is just typical for this area of the country in the summertime. And of course, the presence of the, you know, the Mississippi River being so close, river like that does end up generating lots and lots of humidity for the, you know, the local area that surrounds it. I've got a couple of more comments that were sent to me by Scott Mitchell that does the Uncommon Sense podcast, located at scottpodcast.com. And then if we've got time for it, I've got some email and, you know, kind of news stories, a little bit of email and some news stories that, you know, to kind of go through. So let's see. Let's go ahead, first of all, I guess, and go through this. I've got one of the Scott's comments. It's about 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And I'll probably end up doing a stop-start on it. So here is Scott.
Okay, another note here. I am doing a Tomathon today. I've gone through two podcasts, and I'm into a third one now, which I won't get finished today. And I don't know what tomorrow may bring, but I don't have too many more before I'm entirely up to date. And I've literally been taking every podcast every day, which I don't think I've done that in... well, quite some time, Tom. But, by the way, you should consider this a compliment, because generally after a few podcasts, I jump out of it anyway, because I just, you know, A, lack of time, but B, and more importantly, the, you know, it'll become predictable and I'll lose interest. And I think the reason I could say that this isn't happening is there's been much more of an up-tempo kind of a spirit in these podcasts that I'm hearing, and I like it. You're playing music, you're talking about technology and other subjects, and not so much beating the political drum, which I think is a great thing. I really do. I mean, there's nothing wrong with Political Corner, don't get me wrong. I sink my teeth into that, but I just wanted to mention that. Okay, I tried to do something phenomenal and remember a bunch of things using my mega memory techniques here from that shyster Kevin Trudeau. It was the first course I ever took. The first thing I ever got from Kevin Trudeau, and I used to think the guy was quite a guy back then. I liked him, and I thought that the course helped me a lot. I used to brag to a lot of people about it. And nowadays, when I see what he's turned into, it's really a pity, because I used to like the guy. The mega memory did work for me. So, okay, let's see if I can remember all these different things in order here. This is going to be amazing, because I normally cannot keep these many things in my head, but I said I should be able to do this, and if I can't, Well, too bad. They're all going to go away. Sometimes just keeping two things in my head can be a problem. But I'm going to try and keep four things here. I'm going to go in reverse order, I think. Flem and the BBs, a group of which I am pretty familiar. My partner in the house, Homer, was a big fan, and I used to hear that music kind of wafting upstairs as he would play this and he'd play it loud. And it was good music, and eventually I came to quite like it. I never really knew the background, so I want to thank you for kind of reading me, you know, all about them. That was interesting, having been as familiar with it as I am. Ian, I hear that name so many times in your email, I swear he's probably second only to me in being on your podcast. Hello, Ian from Canada. I'd like to know a lot more about him. Okay, those are the two quickies. Hey, I'm doing pretty good so far. Okay, false teeth. I got to thinking about this tonight. I'm working out on the machine, and I saw this ad for something to do with dentistry, I think, where they can... from what I could tell, I wasn't listening to audio, but instead of having false teeth, what they have is a complete upper plate that they attach right to the bone of your mouth so that it's more like a permanent fixture and a lot like your real teeth. And it got me to thinking about how, you know, very few people anymore have false teeth. At least to my reckoning, I don't know of many people. Now, I got to tell you, by the time my dad and mom were my current age, they both had false teeth. They had partial plates or full plates. I know, because I remember them taking them in and out.
Okay, well, let me interrupt. The false teeth thing, it's interesting. I've thought about that, too. You know, both of my parents have false teeth. You know, and they have had, I think my mom has had an upper plate for, you know, years and years and years. And, you know, I don't know what the difference is today. But, you know, I think what happened, I think people just, you know, I don't know, maybe the awareness grew. You know, dentists have been fighting this thing, you know, trying to get people aware for years and years. Now, when I was a kid, you know, of course your parents tell you to brush your teeth, and they're always telling you to brush your teeth. And I got to be kind of a young adult before I really began to, you know, I realized, hey, you know, this is really to my advantage, you know, because this is painful. This dentistry stuff is painful. You know, I ended up with some capped teeth and so on and so forth, and even an abscess or two. And that stuff is kind of not pleasant. And I finally realized, hey, you know, all I've got to do is brush my teeth once a day, and then there's this stuff called dental floss. You know, and it's not that big of a deal. Most people talked about this before a long time ago. Most people, they say, oh, I don't like dental floss. It makes my gums bleed. Well, it's because you're doing it wrong. You're not supposed to, you know, get the dental floss in, you know, up in there and then start seesawing back and forth, you know, slicing into your gum. That's not the right way to do it. All you have to do is just pop that up in there. And don't seesaw back and forth, but just pop it up in there, and that's enough to break up the bacterial colony that is naturally kind of continually forming in your mouth and in between your teeth. And so the idea is to just break that up. And and if you want to know, you know, the human mouth is filthy, dirty. You know, from a germ standpoint, it's really bad. You know, if say, a human being bites you, a human bite is dangerous. You know, so in any case, if you want to know what goes on, you know, just after you've used your dental floss, smell of it and ask yourself, what does this smell like? You know, I've used this dental floss. What does it smell like afterwards? And I think you're going to be shocked, but you shouldn't be, because whenever you start to eat, You've got saliva, and that saliva naturally begins to break down the food. That's where the digestive process starts, is as soon as you put the food in your mouth and take a bite and begin to chew it. And it smells like digestive process, is, you know, to be, you know, to put it politely, you know. But just smell of that dental floss and see what that smells like. That's your mouth. And you want to kind of try to, you know, all it takes is once a day. You don't have to brush after every meal and what have you. If you just if you brush once a day, and sometimes you can even skip, but brush once a day and do the floss. Try to do the floss once a day. Save yourself a ton of pain. And, you know, it may not, you know, you may have to have a filling here or there possibly, but you're going to save yourself a bunch of pain. But I think, you know, our parents probably, you know, I'm talking, you know, I'm 55 years old. Scott, I think, is 57, 58. So we're kind of the same generation. Our parents, you know, probably weren't aware of it. They weren't aware of the, you know, they weren't aware of how, you know, how just a little bit of brushing and flossing. You know, maybe dental floss didn't even exist then. I guess you could have used thread to do the same thing. You know, put some wax on it or something to make it work better. But it hadn't probably had, I don't know what the history of dental floss is, but when it was invented. But just brushing, people probably didn't do it. And their teeth were, you know, they ended up with the bacteria in their mouth. Bacteria sets up a colony, and it just causes all kinds of problems. And therefore, you end up with abscesses, and you lose your teeth. And it was common, you know, I think another difference is that at one time, you know, dentists just had this idea, oh, we'll just pull this problem tooth. This is a problem tooth. We're just going to pull it. We'll do false teeth. And the dentistry, I think, they decide, you know, over a period of time, they kind of developed more of a culture of, we can save this tooth. You know, we've got new techniques of tooth fillings, bonding materials, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We can save this tooth instead of just pulling it. So, you know, I think that's probably it's just an evolution of dentistry. And, you know, but really, all you got to do, you don't have, you know, if you don't like to go to the dentist and you don't like pain, it's to your advantage. Just brush your teeth and floss. Floss once a day. Do it the proper way. And you're going to save, you know, it's in my experience, you're going to save yourself a ton of pain. So, anyway, let me go ahead and play some more of Scott's comment.
So I know that had to be the case. And my father didn't live much beyond my current age, quite honestly. So, in any case, I think of how blessed I am. I don't know if it's my luck of my draw, or that I'm taking better care of them, or probably even more likely, we got better dentistry today. Because why else? You know, am I that much better than my father at taking care of my teeth? I don't know. I mean, I do floss, and I doubt that he did. I do have ultrasonic toothbrushes and things. And I think probably more modern dentistry has probably been the big factor. So I wonder what you think about that, Tom. Do you think, you can do these stop, start, and answer, but I wonder if you think that it's true. Are there a lot less people in your knowledge that have false teeth than what used to when you were younger? Because that's just been my experience. And the final thing is more in a political realm. It's along the lines of what I call political name-calling. But, you know, I got to thinking about this because, as you were just mentioning on this podcast, I was listening to some left-wing podcasts, and I heard an interesting point made, which I had heard made from the right as well. Basically, you may recall, I think you've made it, that Bill Clinton is a sociopath. Why is he a sociopath? Because part of sociopathic behavior is that you don't have any morals. You don't have any scruples. You don't feel for other people. So you don't care how you hurt other people. You just basically use people to your own end. And so everybody figured Bill Clinton's a sociopath because he pretends he cares about people, but in the, you know, in the real world, gee, we know he doesn't, and you know, all the things he's doing, you know, we can see he's sociopathic. Look at how charming he is to the women, you know, and his sexual escapades and all that are well known. So, you know, for many reasons, and people would even, you know, I think you were reading them, you know, the Clinton body count, you know, that, you know, they're responsible for all these people dying, and they don't care because they're sociopaths. So I thought that was interesting, because I think I made the point at the time when this was being bantered about, I said, you know, I've heard the same thing come from the other side. And sure enough, I did. I heard people saying this about George Bush. And this podcast kind of reminded me of exactly what the angle was, because I was trying to think, what's the angle? How did they say that? And then it kind of brought it all forward. And that was, the angle was this, you know, George Bush is a sociopath, just like Clinton. Why? Well, for the same reasons, that he doesn't care about the pain and suffering of other people, and he doesn't have morals. He wants to take our rights away from us. No person with morals and doing the right thing would do that. He doesn't care about the suffering of people, so therefore he's not in favor of enacting any bills that help the little guy and help people out. And all he really wants to do is make money and line his own pockets at the expense of the little guy. Therefore, sociopath. And
okay, let me interrupt. You know, I believe, obviously, George Bush, George W. Bush, and his dad as well, H.W. Bush, both of them are flawed, clearly. I don't see George Bush as a sociopath. You know, and I do see the Clintons as kind of sociopathic. Barack Obama, I see as a psychopath. Now, what is a psychopath? You know, because you hear these terms, sociopath, psychopath. Well, a psychopath, if you think about it, psychopath is psychopath. You know, they're psychopathic or they're psychotic. Psychopathic. And what is psychotic? Psychotic means that if you're psychotic, it means that you're sort of living in at least a, you know, kind of a, at least a partial lie, or it could be a complete lie. But a psychotic person, someone that's psychotic, they have a hard time distinguishing their friends from their enemies. A sociopath really just doesn't care. You know, they just don't care. But someone that's psychotic can't distinguish, you know, they're just kind of in, you know, in a, kind of, you know, in a lie world, in a dream world. And I really believe that to one extent or another, we're all a little bit psychotic, and you know we've got, in other words, our concept, the concept that we have in our brains of the world around us may not be true. You know, parts of it, you know, we've, you know, there, for whatever reason, parts of it aren't quite right. And you know, it's an interesting thing. I believe that obviously, when, you know, when we're kids, we come into the world, we learn, you know, we learn from our parent, you know, our environment, we have our parents there, hopefully, so on and so forth, and we kind of grow out of, we kind of grow out of that, you know, if you want to call it kind of a soil. You know, but human beings, we've also got this other thing called conscience. You know, and in a couple, three podcasts ago, I was talking about, you know, how, you know, they did a test with babies, and they found out that babies actually know the difference between right and wrong. You know, kind of on a very rudimentary level, they know the difference. And, you know, we come into this world kind of expecting just disappearance, and we want to see justice. You know, we have this innate knowing of right and wrong, and we want to see. You know, we come into the world wanting to kind of see justice happen, and then when it doesn't, of course, what's the first thing we do? We resent. You know, that we resent our parents starting out, usually because they're the first people we deal with. We resent, you know, kind of playing God in our own minds. We have that, you know, we have that proclivity to do that. And, you know, but ultimately, where does your identity come from? You know, where does it come from? Where should it come from? More importantly, you know, once you're an adult, you begin to think about these things, and you realize that your identity, there's something flawed about it. There's something wrong. There's something flawed with the way you're living and the way you're relating to the world. Then you begin to ask this question, where should my identity come from? You know, it's, should it come completely from the outside and just be a, you know, should your identity be based on just who your parents were and what part of the country you're from and so on and so forth? Should it be that? Or, you know, or should your ideas of right and wrong be that? Be based strictly on that? Or is there something more that you've, you know, that you, maybe you've, for whatever reason, you were tricked at kind of driving a wedge between you and it? I believe that, you know, ultimately, where should our identity come from? It should come, you know, I believe human beings, you know, we've got this latent set of ethics. And I've talked about it rather extensively in the past, in past podcasts. And that's ultimately where it should come from. And we have to choose that. We have to want that. We have to want that, you know, that sense of identity. And it can't be done egotistically. We have to get our own egos out of the way. It can't be done resentfully. You know, so, but the idea that, you know, you're psychotic, you know, if you let me see if I can explain the you know, this concept that I have. If your real identity comes from God, or, you know, or somehow comes from within you, you know, and I believe it comes from God, you know, that if you want to be a real person and really know the difference between right and wrong, that identity, that real identity, and it's unique for each human being, potentially, that comes from God, or you could say evolution or wherever, but it's there. And that is reality. But then you have the problem of, you know, you came into the world, you resented, and then when you resent something, you become what you hate. You start absorbing the environment around you, and it may be wrong. You know, your ideas are not your own. The thoughts that you're having are not your own, and they may be very well flawed. They're probably wrong, you know, because people have a tendency, you know, when you have an externalized identity, everybody kind of want, you know, they cry in their beer together, and everybody, you know, tends to be too supportive of the wrong, you know, kind of helping people drive a wedge between themselves and their conscience. You know, I'm okay, you're okay type of thing. And that is where the psychotic thing comes from. And so, you know, we all probably to one extent or another end up believing things that are false about, you know, reality. And so therefore, you know, by that definition, we're somewhat psychotic. And that's why we often don't know that, you know, who's really our friend, who's really our enemy. That's why, you know, the human heart, quote unquote, is so deceptive, because we, you know, we're psychotic to one extent or another. And if we're really psychotic, then we're a you know, you have the word, or, you know, psychopath. And I believe Barack Obama is psychopathic. I don't think that, you know, I don't think he's inherently evil. He's not an Adolf Hitler, but he's not a real person. He's kind of been externalized, and it's his personality's kind of based on grievances and what have you. And that's, you know, he was abandoned by parents. He's gone through a bunch of that. And he's emerged, you know, he's psychotic, and he just doesn't, you know, I don't believe that the man is inherently evil. You know, I think that he's just psychotic. He's not a sociopath, but a psychopath. So, I don't know. These are interesting terms, but so anyway, let's go ahead and listen to more of Scott's comment.
That was the way I remembered the thing going. And it's the same with a lot of other names that are, you know, people bring up on both the extreme ends, you know, like megalomaniac, you know. I've heard that used about both sides. You know, I think one time I pointed out, I said, well, probably just as much as Clinton could be considered a megalomaniac, then maybe Bush could too, or Obama, you know. We could probably find signs of it in all of them. But here's the thing. When you really get to these terms, what you're really doing, and you have to realize this, is that old cherry-picking thing again. Because if you look up sociopath, you can't diagnose somebody as a sociopath based on one symptom or just a couple of symptoms. It has to be more far-reaching than it has to be a whole realm of behavior. And the same would be true of megalomaniac and any of these other words that people just love to throw around, because they can find a few of the symptoms. They can cherry pick the data and they can find a few of the symptoms to show that it rings true. And that's where cherry picking wins out. And so that's what I wanted to point out on that, because it became clear in my mind the other day how that one worked, you know, on the sociopathic behavior, and I couldn't remember it before. And then when I heard this, I said, ah, yeah, that's how they did it. And so basically both sides can call the other sociopaths and megalomaniacs and all the rest of it, and it's just name-calling. It doesn't address any of the issues.
Okay, well, thank you, Scott. Generally speaking, now I'm, you know, of course I'm not perfect, but generally speaking, when I use a term like that, you know, I try to back it up. I try to explain why I think that, the background as to why something is a certain way, you know, if I use a certain term, you know, like, Bill Clinton and I think Hillary too are, sociopathic. They may not, there are varying degrees of it. And, it's funny how, you know, your mind, the human mind can, do little tricks in order to not think that it's wrong, you know, and to kind of drive a wedge between real knowledge of right and wrong. And, you know, kind of get people around you to kind of agree that you're really okay, you're really good, and you're really not a rotten so-and-so, even though you probably are. So, anyway, the other comment that you made, and I wanted to, I'm talking about more technology and less political stuff. And, that kind of comes across as more upbeat. The problem, you know, I'm still reading all these political stories. And the problem is not, you know, the conclusion I've come to, I've talked about this, the conclusion I've come to, you know, we're not going to solve the problems with, you know, laws and tweaking and so on and so forth. And so there are plenty of people that are emphasizing, you know, and talking about what the problems are, you know, and you know, I don't think that we're going to solve the problem with laws. The real problem is morals, moral decay, and that centers around this exact topic we're talking about. What is the source of your identity? Because if, you know, this is my belief. I believe that if you're a real person and you really face your conscience and you really take that as the source of your identity, you are going to be a moral person. You could take the laws away and you're still not going to rape. You're still not going to rob. You're still not going to pillage and murder and steal and so on and so forth. You know, so that's the real issue. How do we get people to look at themselves? How do we get people to want to find their real identities? You know, that's the issue. And I think that that's done primarily. You can try to change laws or whatever. That doesn't really work all that well. You know, you can do so much with laws, and that's about it. But what you really need to do is begin, you know, figure out how can, you know, first of all, you have to look at yourself. Really have a willingness to look at yourself. And then secondly, you have to be able to, you know, then if you can honestly really look at yourself and really kind of people can see you're coming from the right place, then you can begin to try to influence people around you. And the idea is, you know, get them to look at themselves. Don't try to influence them so much politically or whatever, or, you know, or this policy or that policy's, this policy's bad, that policy's good. Try to get them to look at themselves. I don't want to be anyone's idea of what is right and wrong. I don't want to be anyone's guru. My mission, what I want to do is to get whoever's listening, you, me, who, you know, anyone that's listening, I want them to be, you know, anyone I encounter, I want them to look at themselves. And I want them to have their own direct connection with reality. And then the morals will take care of themselves automatically. And that's really what has to happen. It's, you know, and one area of attack would be the school system, you know, our nationalized public school system. That's a huge area of attack. You know, how can we take that back? How can we influence that? That's what needs to happen, is we need to begin to influence that. Instead of just writing it off, we need to begin to influence it if we can, you know, and influence the way people think. But not by influencing them externally, but by getting them to look at themselves. Now, when you approach people that way, some people, you're going to make enemies. Some people don't like that approach. You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, lately when I, you know, because I can, you know, I tend, you know, I'm conservative. I, you know, I make no secret of that. I politically, I'm conservative. And when I talk to somebody, I can immediately, you know, within a few seconds usually, if I can tell, you know, if they're on the left, it sticks out like a sore thumb to me. But lately, I'm not talking, you know, I'm just going straight for the jugular, morality. And it's kind of amazing, you know, there are people that are on the left that will agree that morals have declined and that it's a problem. And that's the real, you know, all of these, you know, whether it's the left or the right or this policy's, you know, versus that policy. If you can go for the, you know, the real jugular is the moral arguments, you know, and get people to see where we've really gone wrong, you know, because we don't have we've got too many people that aren't genuine at this point. So, anyway, I've got another comment here from Scott. So let's go ahead. We're going to be listening to this for the first time together. And this one's short. It's only 1 minute and 29 seconds. So here is Scott again.
Well, Tom, you're playing all the CDs that I grew up with back in the days of Homer and myself and owning the house back in 1986, 87, 88, somewhere in there. In those years, yes, I was getting into CDs. Homer was getting into CDs. We were cranking it up. The 1812 Overture that you're playing, absolutely, we had it. And Homer had a system that you'd have to see and hear to believe. He's a he's been an audiophile for years. He builds his own equipment at work because he's, you know, a technician, and he's got friends that are. He had this Brewer amplifier that was these huge meters. I mean, take your hand and put it up and spread your fingers out as far as you can, and that's 1 meter, okay? Swinging from your thumb to your little finger, that's one VU meter, and he had two of these big, huge meters on it. And I can't remember how many watts this thing was, but, you know, honestly, it probably could have shook the foundation of the house off. It was a system. And so he used to demonstrate this 1812 Overture and the Flim and the BBs song on that Tricycle album were some of his favorite demo music. And I used to just sit down there and kind of enjoy it with him. So, yeah, like I said, the music I grew up with, you know, CD-wise, right there, you're playing it.
All right, well, thank you, Scott. Those CDs, you know, that music, you know, and it can happen today, you know, just direct to digital recordings, and they've gotten better at it. You know, of course, Flim and the BBs, and all those Telarc, those were mostly classical, although they did some jazz and some other stuff. And of course, Telarc, I do believe, is still around, as well as DMP, Digital Music Products. But those, they were experimenting early on with direct-to-digital recordings. And they've got, you know, over the years, we've gotten better, and we've gotten to the point where we just expect good sound. And you know, like home theaters and the surround sound systems and what have you. You know, they all sound spectacular. You know, if you get the thing set up right, they can sound really good. The amplifiers have gotten better. And, in some ways, you know, some of the sound we listen to every day has gotten worse. You know, the MP3s, if you really push an MP3, it you can make it misbehave. Sometimes I listen to an MP3, and I can kind of hear some pasty, you know, there's this pastiness is the best way to describe it. But that's fine. You know, in a podcast, audio podcast, if someone's just talking, the pastiness really doesn't bother me. I can kind of ignore it. But if I want to really listen to high quality music, you know, then I want to, you know, I want a high quality sound if I can possibly get it. But I don't know. I find that I don't just sit and listen to music very much at all. You know, just maybe on occasion, but not very often. I'm much, you know, and it's been this way for the last several years. I much prefer material, you know, like people talking in podcasts, what have you. I much prefer stuff that I can learn something from or get some kind of substance from, as opposed to just listening to music. That's, you know, lately Adam Curry has, he's restarted the Daily Source Code, and of course in that first episode after he restarted it, he went into all, you know, told this big long story about, he's talking to his dead mother, having this conversation, and she basically kind of told him to have an affair, or that, you know, he's going to meet some woman, and he was still married to Patricia at the time. And that was kind of interesting to listen to. But then, you know, he's done several since then, and now it seems like all he wants to do is just play music. And, you know, that's all well and good, but I don't really care. So I usually I'll fast forward to the through the music to see if he's going to talk, you know, and talk about anything. Because he's an interesting guy. He's very intelligent. He's really savvy when it comes to media and how the media works. And, you know, it's great when he talks about that. You know, basically expresses his insights into it. So, you know, I really don't listen to, to that much music these days. And, just once in a while, you know, I'll kind of listen and kind of enjoy it. But, it's just not something that I spend a lot of time engaging in. I'd much rather have something that, you know, material. And, of course, that's what's wonderful about podcasting. I'd much rather have material that I'm able to choose, that I'm able to actually get something from. And that's where podcasting really excels, because it enables me to get exactly what I'm looking for. I'm able to pick and choose, get precisely what I'm looking for, and I'm able to get the material that I'm after and not just have to be at the mercy of a radio station that I happen to be passing near, just listening to CDs or back in the day, audio cassettes. So, anyway, I guess we still have a little bit of time here. So thank you, Scott. I'm going to go ahead and go through some of the email and the stories here that I have. So I got this. I guess this was from Facebook. It's from Herman from the Netherlands. It says, "Hey there, Tom. I've been following your podcast now for a couple of years, and I like them very much. I try to keep up with them, but sometimes I miss one. I was curious about your filming of the wedding from your niece, and of course I would like to be your Facebook friend. Greetings from the Netherlands, Herman." And so I guess it's been about 3 months ago now. I videotaped one of my niece's weddings, there at Hot Springs, Arkansas, where they had it. And, I made a couple of short videos. And so I I'd mentioned that. So in any case, I sent Herman the links to those. I didn't just go ahead and publish them on YouTube or publish them on my website, because I did have some, I did put RIAA music in it, and didn't want to publicize that. But it's perfectly fine to do it for private stuff. So that's what I did. So, but in any case, thank you, Herman. Let's see. So then there was this, I think this article was sent to me by Ken. "More of us are checking our online reputations. More adults, especially young adults between the ages of 18 and 39, are actively monitoring what is being said and posted about themselves online and taking steps to protect their privacy, according to a new report from the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. Contrary to common assumptions, young adults are in many ways the most active managers of their online reputation," said Mary Madden, a Pew senior research specialist and lead author of the report Reputation Management and Social Media. "Young adults are also more likely than older adults to limit the information they share online, especially on social networking sites such as Facebook." So, I don't know. This goes on and on and on. "Adults over the age of 50 are not as active in sharing information on social networking sites and other spaces online. So there may be an assumption that there's not much content available that's connected to their names online," she said. "However, even if you're not a social media user yourself, that doesn't mean you don't have a presence on those networks. Photos, videos, and comments about you may circulate without your involvement. Indeed, 47% of social networking site users aged 18 to 39 say they have deleted comments others have made on their profiles, Pew said, compared with just 29% of those aged 40 to 49 and 26% of those aged 60 to 74. 41% of users 18 to 39 said they have removed their names from photos that were tagged or identified online, compared to 24% of users aged 40 to 49 and 18% of those aged 50 to 74. So I don't know. So that was the article here. And then there's an article here sent by Ian. Truck driver pleads to manslaughter in New York crash that occurred as his computer streamed porn. Batavia, New York, an Ohio truck driver has pleaded guilty to manslaughter after his rig hit a disabled car on a New York highway while his laptop computer streamed pornography. Authorities say Thomas Wallace of Brook Park, Ohio, had little sleep before the December 12 crash on the New York State Thruway that killed Julie Stratton of Snyder, New York. He pleaded guilty Tuesday to second-degree manslaughter. Stratton hit a deer and her car was disabled in the passing lane shortly before Wallace's tractor-trailer struck it from behind. The accident happened in Pembroke, about 20 miles east of Buffalo. The 45-year-old trucker faces 5 to 15 years in prison when he is sentenced in September. And, you know, all it takes is just a few people, you know, because considering, you know, there are millions of truck drivers, all it takes is a small percentage of people to do something stupid like, you know, play a video while they're driving. And I've seen people do that because I can look over in the truck, you know, and sometimes they've, you know, it's really obvious. They got the laptop up on their dash, right in the middle of the dash, and it's playing a video. Or sometimes they've got it, you know, over on the, you know, kind of like more on the passenger side, and they're playing with it, you know, they got the thing on and it's playing some kind of video. You know, now there's a lot of drivers have laptops that they can get to while they're driving. But, you know, to be honest, I think probably what, you know, they're running GPS software. But there are some I've seen them playing movies. And, you know, that's actually, it's illegal. In most states, you know, I'd say most jurisdictions, it's illegal. The driver should not be able to see a screen, you know, with some kind of television or movie content. And so here's this guy, you know, streaming his pornography. So he should go to jail. You know, that's ridiculous. You know, so who knows? But it, you know, this type of stuff does happen. You know, so anyway. Let's see here. So thank you, Ian, for sending that along. Then I got this email from Caleb. It says, "Hi, Tom. Just had a few questions about the CB radio situation. I've heard on a few occasions speak of not having a CB radio in your truck. I'm really curious as to how you deal with a few situations. First, let me say I never use a CB radio for any kind of general chit-chat. And for that matter, I rarely turn it on due to the disrespectful and downright vulgar nature of the CB. I am a ham radio operator, and I use the 2-meter or VHF bands to communicate in a general chit-chat conversation. The difference being that hams are very respectful to anyone and everyone. I heard an audio comment from another one of your listeners talking about QSL cards. I must say that I've never sent or received any QSL cards. I think that that is primarily done by operators of the HF lower frequency long distance bands. In any case, that brings me to my questions. The only time I use a CB radio is to communicate with the fuel desk at truck stop while I'm on the truck scales, and when a shipper or receiver wants to use the CB to alert you that a door is ready or something of that nature. How do you deal with these situations? I would really enjoy taking this CB out of my truck and use the space for something more useful. Anyway, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. As always, I enjoy each podcast. Thank you for taking the time to make your podcast available regularly. P.S. Again, thanks again for the Netflix tip. I love the streaming feature, and that's from Caleb. And Caleb's got his ham call sign. It's KF7HOG. So KF7HOG. So thank you, Caleb. Now, you know, whenever I came to work for Schaefer, and that's been about 5 years ago, this, you know, the CB radio worked in my other truck, and then whenever I came to work for Schaefer, could never get it to work, and so I just kind of put it away and forgot about it. And, you know, so if I, you know, I always go, usually, if I have to weigh the truck, I try to go to a CAT scale, because they always have the thing right there that you can call the fuel desk directly with. You know, that panel right there that, you know, they've got that panel, you press the button, and then somebody at the fuel desk answers and takes down your information and tells you to come inside. But if, you know, in the case where, you know, if it's an odd scale and they want you to call on the CB radio, usually what I'll have to do is just, you know, go inside and tell them, hey, I'm on the scale. I need you to, you know, I don't have a CB radio. I'm on the scale. Weigh my truck. And so, you know, you can do it without a CB. You can exist without a CB radio. It's entirely possible. Sometimes it's a little bit of an inconvenience. Now, if I had a CB radio that was functioning in here and I got in a situation where I needed it, I would obviously use it. But since I don't, I'm not going to spend $50. I'm not going to spend $100 to get a CB radio. You know, because it's just not that big. You know, it's just not my priority. I don't care about it. Then the other situations, you know, occasionally I'll run into a situation with a shipper or receiver. They'll want to call on the CB radio, CB radio channel 5, and we'll call you into the door or whatever. And I just start shaking my head, and there are a lot of drivers actually that don't have CB radio, so it is more of a common thing than you think. And I think a lot of drivers just have them because everybody they think that everybody else has them, and you know they think, oh well, I can't be different, I've got to be like everybody else, and so I have to have one too, you know, so I'll be like every other driver. But there are a lot of drivers that actually don't have them. And you can exist, you know, no problem at all. You can exist without them. Because I've done it, you know, I've done it for years. Periodically I've had one, and then, for a lot of the time I haven't had. And I haven't had one for the last 5 years, you know. And I exist just fine without it, so. But one time I had I think it was a receiver. They kind of said, well, you don't have a CB radio. You have to wait in our break room. Just wait in the break room, and somebody will be in there in a few minutes and tell you what door to back in. And so I did. You know, I did that. But a lot of the time, a lot of these places now are asking, you know, they're not even asking for your, you know, telling you about the CB radio. They just ask for your cell phone number. Do you have a cell phone? Yeah. Well, give us the number, and we'll call you. And that's actually a much more efficient way. And I'm finding that increasingly more common. So anyway, thank you, Caleb. Well, let's see here. I think that's going to do it for now. We're hitting 59 minutes. By the way, I should have mentioned this before. We're a little late in the podcast to do it, but I want to talk... Just mention a little bit about yourbabycanread.com. Your Baby Can Read is a truly revolutionary infant reading system. It was developed by a leading infant researcher, Dr. Robert Titzer, who taught his own daughter to read when she was just 9 months old. Your Baby Can Read taps into children's natural ability to learn language in the first 5 years of life. The reading system includes videos, books, flashcards, and games. Go to www.yourbabycanread.com to watch real home videos of infants and toddlers reading, a six-month-old recognizing words on flashcards, an 18-month-old reading sentences, a toddler reading Charlotte's Web. Try it yourself risk-free and see what your child can do. Visit www.yourbabycanread.com. Give the lifelong gift of early literacy to your child. So, so anyway, what time is it? It's like 1:32 a.m., and so it's probably going to be a little while yet before I get to bed, and then, so I'm going to time it. You know, I've got some extra time. I had a few extra hours, you know, so I wouldn't just, you know, 10-hour break and then hurry up and get to where I was going. I do have some extra time, so I can kind of probably still get enough sleep and, you know, as much sleep as I want, and then still manage to, you know, because the delivery appointment is at 11 p.m. Eastern Time Friday evening. You know, that's 10 p.m. Central Time. So I've, you know, and as I say, I'm down to about 400 miles or so, from here. So I'll, you know, just kind of figure out what time I need to get up and, you know, get out of here, and in order to, you know, at least get to the place where I'm going to, you know, give myself a good couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours extra, you know, just in case I run into any traffic problems or what have you. So anyway, hope everyone is having a great week, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.